Excision of 12049, reel 4.
Mr. Maninsky, reel 4.
In the period when I was working, actually, on the road, then we had a day off every 10 days. And, of course, the odd hour or two in the evening. And I would do what drawing I could on my days off. But while I was in Tarsau, I'd got a very slight shrapnel wound on my right ankle when we were on Singapore. It was so tiny, I didn't even go sick with it. I mean, it was just a nick, really. And I had no decent shoes, and while I was working on this road, cutting bamboo, I scratched the scar with green bamboo, which, of course, is extremely poisonous. And I developed a tropical ulcer, which grew to enormous size. I mean, you couldn't cover it with a saucer when it was really bad. And I was then put in hospital. And I never actually worked again for the Japanese from that day forward, because I was evacuated from there to Chiang Kai, which was a supposed hospital camp, and from there to Tamawang, and then to Nag Ngan Paton. And what Major Moon, who looked after me and was with me in all those camps, what he did was, once I was able to walk, which was some considerable time, I may say, it was about a year before I could walk, he would provide me with the material, and by that I mean he would come to me with a fellow with a very bad wound and say, would you draw this for me, and so on. And I would do the drawing, perhaps, first of all, it was generally a very badly ulcerated leg. I would draw the ulcerated leg, and then he would clean it, and then I would do another drawing, and then he would do a pin graft. And I would do a drawing of the scar, so there was a complete record of the progress of the wound. And from then on, whilst I was unable to walk, the stuff was brought to me to do in bed, because I was sort of confined to, well, bed isn't the word, but you know what I mean. I was confined to the hospital. When I was better and able to walk, he got me a sort of a job as a medical orderly in the operating theatre. Well, I didn't know anything about medical things, but that was merely a way of disguising the fact that I was drawing. It kept me from being sent back onto working parties.
How valuable was it to him to have a record of these drawings?
Well, I presume it must have been valuable. I know that he wrote a book after the war called The Clinical Aspects of Modern Warfare. I've never seen a copy, but I know a lot of the drawings were used there. And it seemed to me that it was extremely valuable to him, because he kept me away from work. I mean, certainly I would have had difficulty in working, because I've been lame ever since and my leg was in a terrible state. I couldn't certainly have gone and worked with a pickaxe or anything like that, you know. I mean, would have been out of the question. But I certainly could have done some jobs, but he made sure I didn't. I mean, he sort of took me onto the hospital staff, and that's really kept me out of... From the time we went to... After about a year, I suppose, on the railway, I went to Chiang Kai, which was an extraordinary camp. It was a terrifying place in many ways, because on an average there was between 25 and 30 people a day died in Chiang Kai, a lot of them with amoebic dysentery, and eventually they only had one funeral a day, so it was only sound the last post once, because it became very depressing. But it became a very well organised camp. We had a theatre there, and some of the things they did were quite amazing. For one of the things, which when I think about it now, I shudder, because I've attended hospital a great deal since the war with my leg. They had so little to dress the wounds with, and most of the dressings were torn-up shirts and things, that every morning when the dressings were taken off, they were put into a biscuit tin and boiled. So you had a sort of stew of dressings. And they were then taken out and put into another lot of water, and they were reused time and time again. I mean, when you think of modern hygiene, I mean, it's quite extraordinary. They built de-infestation units, because most of us had body lice, which got into your blankets, and they some clever individuals, by organising a lot of empty biscuit tins, made a steam unit. You had a fire at one end, and you could pass your blankets through steam. And, of course, eventually we freed ourselves of body mites. It's quite amazing, considering that we had so little to do it with. The other thing was the huts were infested with bed lice, and what we did was, periodically, the platforms that we slept on were made of bamboo, and we would light a fire at the end of each hut, and every single strip was taken out, and they were passed through the fire. People stood all day doing that to burn the eggs. So eventually we rid ourselves totally of body lice and of bed bugs. The ingenuity that was used in Chiang Kai was absolutely incredible. There was fellows making artificial limbs, because a lot of men lost their limbs. In fact, you have the drawings I did of them. The chaps made, I remember one thing, made a rib shear out of a kitchen tap. I mean, there were instrument makers that made the most extraordinary things to help the doctors. It was an amazing camp. We had a very good theatre there, until we blotted our copybook, which was totally unintentional. But the Japanese used to come to our shows because they had no entertainment at all. I mean, it was just as important to them as it was to us, almost. And we had a variety show, and one of the acts or whatever was Tarzan and the Apes, and these fellows came on dressed as apes, but unfortunately they looked like Japanese. The Japanese were convinced we were taking the mickey, so they closed the theatre there and then, stopped it, but that only lasted for about 3 months, and we allowed us to carry on the theatre. We had wonderful lectures there. There were chaps that came around giving lectures. There was one man who was a teacher of history at Raffles University, and he used to give lectures on the French Revolution, all sorts of things, and they were packed. I mean, it was at night. He'd come into the hut and sit at the end. And a lot of men must have learned a great deal about the culture of their own civilization that they would never have learned under normal circumstances. I mean, it was a very well-organized camp. Then they moved us to Tamuan, and which again was another hospital camp. And there weren't so many people died there. I mean, what Tamuan was formed for was people that the doctors had decided were totally disabled. In other words, they would not be able to be of any use to the Japanese again. So Tamuan became a camp for the disabled. Excuse me, so it was mostly limbless people, or people with one leg, or people like myself who had this scar on my foot. Well, it was not, still hadn't healed actually, but it was better. And there were people that had severe amoebic dysentery. There were people there, and there were very few of those who had pellagra of the brain, so they'd become mental cases. And Tamuan, again, was an extremely well-organized camp. It was the most peaceful of the places that I was in, and the guards took very little notice of us. We just ran our own lives. And at the end of every hut, we dug the ground up and we grew various things, and kankon, which is a sort of spinach and things like that. It was a peaceful place, Tamuan. Something happened there which I have never forgotten. A point I haven't made, which I'm sure you're probably aware of, is that with the exception of the camp officials, our guards were Koreans. They weren't Japanese. Some of them were extremely cruel when we were working on the railway. They were far crueler than the Japanese were. But on the other hand, they were treated almost like prisoners of war. I mean, they didn't live under very pleasant circumstances. And if they did anything wrong, they were beaten up in front of us. I mean, the Jap corporal or sergeant, whatever, would walk over and smack them from one side of the face to the other till they were down on their knees. But although they were the people that caused most of our discomfort because of their cruelty. There was some of them that were nice people. I mean, there was one, Yoshiyama, who was in Tarsal when I was there, who was one of the most charming men I've ever met. I mean, if you were on a Yoshiyama working party, you did more sitting down doing nothing than you ever did work. And he was very sympathetic to us, and he used to try and help by bringing us supplies of toilet paper, because, I mean, that's a thing we never had, or we'd bring soap into us, and so on. But once we got to Tamawan, we had very few guards. Well, we didn't in Chiang Kai, but in Tamawan, we hardly saw a guard. They took it for granted that we couldn't escape. We were surrounded by jungle. Occasionally, they'd come in and do a roll call, but it ceased to be once a day. It would be probably once a week. No one tried to escape anyway. Well, one or two people did, but they didn't get very far. And Tamawan was a peaceful camp. It was almost as if it was a... One took a breath, you know. And then, of course, they moved us to Nakhonpattan, which was supposed to be a Red Cross camp. And for the first time, we were in a proper prisoner of war camp. We were surrounded by turrets with machine guns pointing in. And we didn't realise at the time, although I was told afterwards, that they had by this time realised the possibility of an invasion in various parts of the Far East, on Japan itself, indeed, and the arrangements had been made that they were going to shoot all prisoners of war. They were just going to turn the machine guns on us, which, of course, as you know, never transpired. It was a well-run camp, but it was at that stage that they decided to take most of our officers away from us. They evacuated the officers to a camp and left us with the bare minimum, mostly medical officers. They also, I presume at that stage, managed to get rid of most of the radio sets, because we always had radios. The news was given out probably 3 months, or certainly 2 months late, so that if we talked about it in the huts, we could have heard it from the Chinese, because there was always some communication between us and the people in the villages in the jungle, because when you were out on a working party, you met them. I mean, they were working too, bringing up food and supplies and etc. Some of them spoke a little English. So after 2 months, it would be fair to say that you might have heard it from them, but if it was given out the day it was actually transmitted and you talked about it, there was always a possibility that one of the Japs, because some of them spoke English, and they would wander around very quietly, and if they overheard you discussing something that happened the day before, then they would immediately realise you had a radio. But we certainly had radios, and we certainly got information, albeit a couple of months late. I believe that the radios were quite extraordinary. I mean, they were made by fellows whose whole life had been dedicated to radio, and they were made out of all sorts of scraps and sort of kept in mess tins and hidden in hollow trees and so on and so forth. I remember one very amusing moment about the radios, because I said to you earlier about there was always this sense of humour that permeated everywhere. In fact, at one stage in Tarsal, when things were extremely bad, the cholera had broken out north of us at Kinsayo, and the camp, of course, was immediately isolated, and hundreds of people died with cholera. And the Japs were very concerned about cholera, because they knew darn well that if it took a hole, they were going to get it as well. And the first thing they did was they asked us to guard ourselves. They issued us with pick staves, and the idea was to stop the Chinese and Indians who were working on the railway to come running into the camps, because they had no medical help at all, and as you probably know, about 100,000 of them died on the railway. And they would panic when they felt themselves becoming ill, and they would run in. The one fear was that they would run into our camps and infect us, because Tarsal never ever got cholera. So we guarded ourselves with pick staves, and very rapidly the Japanese brought in anti-cholera serum. And once we'd got the serum, we were all injected, and then it stopped. We didn't get it anymore. And then we had the unpleasant task of going out in working parties and burying the Chinese and Indians that had died in the jungle, and we just dug vast holes and put lime in them and just threw them in, and it was a very unpleasant occupation, because in the last stages of cholera, you go into a coma, and when you're in a cholera coma, you never recover from it, incidentally. In those days, you didn't. Maybe they can do something about it now. It's very difficult to tell whether you're alive or dead. I mean, there's hardly any pulse or heartbeat, and I always used to be in fear and trepidation that we were throwing people into these pits that weren't dead, you know. I suppose, in retrospect, they wouldn't have known anything about it, because they don't recover consciousness, but it was a horrific fall.
Was this at Tarsau or Nakhon
Pathom? At Tarsau, sorry, I'm jumping backwards. Now, why did I tell you that? That was something I was going to say. Oh, yes, and this was a perfect example of the Japanese being afraid of what we were afraid of and doing something about it. And then while we were at Tamuwan, which was, I say, the camp for the disabled, the Japanese started to bring wounded down from Burma, and they came along into the sidings of our camp, because there was an enormous railway siding at the camp, and they were in horrific condition, these fellows. They were in tears, so that they were cattle trucks, the same type of trucks that had taken us up through the jungle from Singapore. We were 30 in a truck when we went up from Singapore, and we were two nights and 3 days in those trucks with hardly any food at all, and only once a day allowed to get off. So you can imagine the state we were in when we got to the other end, especially as a lot of people had diarrhea, and there were quite a lot of people died. But at least we were all on floor level. With the Japanese wounded, there was three layers they'd put in platforms, and they were in a shocking state. Some of them were dead, of course. And we immediately started to make tea. That's one thing we always had, was tea. And we made gallons and gallons of tea, and we always had cigarettes, because you could always get native tobacco. And our medical people, together with some of the lads, went along, and they were going into these trucks and trying to give them hot tea and cigarettes. And the Korean guards were walking up and down looking at us and laughing. They thought it was very funny. But it was a wonderful example to me of the humanity that people can show under the most extraordinary circumstances. I mean, there was no bitterness at all. These men were dying or severely wounded, or dead in many cases, and the one thing the fellows thought of was to give them some succor at that moment. And it's never left me that day. I remember that day so very vividly. They were there for a whole day, you know.
Were there any POWs who thought it was the wrong thing to do?
No. I never heard anyone say that. No.
Which year do you think that might have been?
No, I can tell you. It was the year the war finished. It would be 1945, wouldn't it? Yeah, yes. The early part of 1945. Probably round about February, March of 45. It was only a few months before. No, wait a minute, we're at Tamuwang. I beg your pardon, 44. I'm sorry, 1944, because we went to the Nakhon Pathom.
What was the response of the wounded?
They were grateful. I don't think a lot of them realised who we were. I mean, we must have looked very much like natives. I mean, all we had was Jap happies, you know, these little sort of a piece of cord round there with a flap. And having most of us had a shirt or a pair of shorts, But we didn't wear very much. I mean, we just wore our jacket most of the time. So we were constantly exposed to sun and wind and what have you. And we must have... And most of us had our hair shaved off, out of choice, some may say. It was easier to keep clean. I don't think they would even realise who we were, to be honest. They were they'd been about a week coming down through the jungle, and they were in a shocking state.
And they'd had no attention?
None whatsoever. And the Japanese medical authorities in the camp, because there was always some of them, a doctor and a couple of nurses for their own use, up of their medical orders, they never went near them. They went near them. The only help they got in that particular case was from us.
How can you explain such extraordinary neglect?
I just don't know. I think they were reaching the stage where the number of their wounded was exceeding their capacity to cope with it. And they did the only thing they could do. They shoved them onto these trains, obviously eventually going to Bangkok, where they probably would have gone into some sort of hospital, I don't know. But they were totally neglected. I mean, a lot of them had gangrene. Because once you've lived with gangrene, you know the smell of it. It's a pretty horrific smell it's got. But they were doing nothing for them at all. They had no medical orders on the train.
So it wouldn't be normal Japanese army practice to not to attempt to wound it?
I don't know. I don't know. I think it was reaching the stage where the only thing I can think of, we discussed it at the time, where they couldn't cope any longer with their own casualties. It was a question of trying to get them back as quickly as possible. But one of the things that was holding up getting them back was, of course, that the RAF and the Americans were bombing the railway all the time. I mean, that had started with us when we were in Tarsier. In fact, it became an absolute nuisance because every time they bombed the railway, we had to go out. At least I was never on one of those parties, but men that were had to go out and clear up the mess. I know it sounds selfish, but we almost dreaded them coming over and bombing the railway because it meant that men were thrust in to reconstruct the area that had been destroyed. It made our workload heavier, in other words. And, of course, there were the odd occasions, sadly, when they hit the camps. They didn't hit Tarsier, but they hit, I think, Nom Pla Duc, killed about 70 men, because they always had the camps right alongside the railway, and it would have been very difficult for the odd bomb not to have gone astray. I mean, they were literally cheek by jowl, camp and work, so you couldn't blame the pilots. I only ever had one very unpleasant experience, but nothing actually sort of didn't do any harm. But we were moving down to some work on the road we were working on, and we were actually on tops of the trucks. They were moving us down, and we were sitting or lying, whatever, on tops of the trucks, being taken about 5 miles down to the junction of the road where we were working. And we were going through a cutting in the jungle, and we were certainly not doing more than 10 miles an hour. We were only moving very slowly. And quite suddenly, this aircraft, and I'm not expert enough in aircraft to tell you what it was, but it was a sort of fighter bomber, and it not a very big craft. And it suddenly came down between the trees and flew over the top of us. And we immediately realized it was one of our own aircraft, and we all started to wave, you see, which was a fairly natural thing to do. And he disappeared, then he circled, and he came down a second time, and we waved again. And the third time he came down with his machine guns open. Now, obviously, I mean, in retrospect, you couldn't blame him, because he couldn't have recognised us as being British or Allied prisoners of war. We must have looked like natives or Japanese, because we were wearing these little white Japanese Jap happies, we call them. You had a cord, piece of material, and you just flapped it down. We were all wearing those. That's what we worked in. And fortunately, by this time, the train was only doing about 2 or 3 miles an hour. It was just moving, and everybody leapt into the jungle. So nobody was hit, nobody was hurt. But it made us realise that we were very vulnerable at a time like that, and there was no question we were ever going to wave again. Not that they'd ever happen again, as far as I was concerned. But
how did you come to leave the railway?
Myself?
Yes.
Well, because of my leg, I was taken off that type of work. Which was after about a year working on the road, and then evacuated to Tamawan, which was to Chiang Kai, which was a hospital camp, where I was very ill for a long time, and then into the disabled camp. I never actually worked on the railway after the first year. I only had 1 year.
So you didn't go back to Singapore?
No. When the war finished, we were taken to Bangkok. And actually, we marched a fair part of the way because the Air Force had destroyed some of the bridges. And then we were taken by train to Bangkok. We were put on barges and taken along the river by the Japanese to the go-downs on the riverside. And something happened there, which I have never been very happy about, actually, which I will tell you. We had a lot of Australians with us, and the Australians are very tough. They're a totally different breed to us, I'm afraid. And in the camps, we always kept separate. We might have mixed around the fire, but we had Australians in one hut and Dutch in another, and so on. And we were put on these barges, and we had about four Japanese guards on the barge with us. When I say guards, they weren't guarding us anymore. They were running the barge. And when we arrived at our destination, there wasn't a Jap on the barge. They had disappeared. And I subsequently, talking to other men, discovered that the Australians had quietly disposed of them and put them in the river.
How many?
Well, there were certainly four on our barge, so how many happened on other barges, I've no idea. I was very unhappy about that because, I mean, I don't know whether I'm even right in telling you this, but I mean, I was so horrified because these men, as far as I was concerned, were perfectly innocent. They hadn't been our guards, they had done nothing to us, and in case the war was finished. And, as far as I was concerned, it was a sort of murder, but I mean, what could one do about it?
That was on the way to Bangkok.
We were in Bangkok, and we'd gone down by train, and I can't remember exactly the spot where we were. It was a railway yard, and then we were taken down to the river and put on these barges and taken along to the go-downs, which are warehouses, where we stayed for about 3 or 4 days and nights, and where we were fed. It was part of our journey back. We then flew from there to Rangoon, of course.
How did you hear about the atomic bombs and the liberation, the end of the war?
Well, that was a very difficult thing for me to tell you this. It's we were in Nakhonpattan, and we hadn't heard about the atomic bombs at this stage. But quite suddenly, about 10:30 one morning, people came all the way along the huts. Nakhonpattan was built with a centre road, a proper road for lorries, and there were huts on either side. And then beyond that was the cookhouses and various offices.